Lecture 15, Grace Abounding, the Puritans. Last time we looked at the Anglicans. Today we're going to look at a very distinctive part of the Church of England, the movement that we call the Puritan movement. I'd like to use a prayer from Richard Baxter. Before I do that, let me quote from one of Baxter's books. He wrote many books. One was called How to Lead a Heavenly Life Upon Earth. And when I was reading that some time ago, I came across this statement, which I felt was particularly appropriate to those of us studying at a seminary. Because Baxter warns those that are employed in leading the devotions of others, especially, he says, preachers of the gospel. And this is what he says. Oh, how easily may such be deceived, while they do nothing so much as read and study of heaven, preach and pray and talk of heaven. Is not this the heavenly life? Really what we're doing at the seminary. We're reading and talking and praying and preaching about the Bible and about God and about heaven. Is this the heavenly life? Baxter asks. Alas, all this is but mere preparation. This is but collecting the materials, not erecting the building itself. It is but gathering the manna for others and not eating and digesting it ourselves. So that's a good statement from Richard Baxter, the Puritan, for us as we are gathering and preparing the manna for others to be sure that we too are eating it ourselves. Let's come now to the prayer from Richard Baxter. Let us pray. Lord Jesus, take my spirit. I trust thy love and merit. Take home this wandering sheep, for thou hast sought it. This soul in safety keep, for thou hast bought it. Amen. This is from USA Today. Every inauguration brings on a chorus of moaners, determined to take the fun out of the celebration. They appear in many forms. First, the Puritans, who can't stand to see money spent on anything impractical. This is from the writer Frederick Buechner. One of the grimmer notions that we seem to inherit from our Puritan forebears is that work is not even supposed to be glad, but rather a kind of penance, a way of working off the guilt that you accumulate during the hours when you're not working. This is from the book Listening to Prozac. The author quotes someone who uses the phrase pharmacological Puritanism to express the judgmental quality of the objection to medication. This is from fashion designer Tom Ford. Too much style in America is tacky. In fashion, you can really tell that America is descended from the Puritans. And this is from novelist John Mortimer. My daughter, who I hope would grow up like you, understanding the weakness of mankind, has turned out to be a Puritan. Well, I could read many more statements like this because I've collected these through the years. And I have a rather large file full of statements telling us all about Puritanism. Who are these people, the Puritans, that all these people are saying these bad things about? They're spoil sports, work-obsessed, judgmental, and even tacky people, according to the quotations that I just read. Today we're going to study the Puritans. The cheerful old Puritans. J.I. Packer sometimes says, just to shock people into examining their prejudices and looking at the Puritans in a new light. And we're going to study the history of the Puritans to see what the word really does mean. In the quotation from C.S. Lewis at the top of page 91, he reminds us in the Screwtape Letters that the devil has taken over this word, as Screwtape says to Wormwood. The value we have given to that word is one of the really solid triumphs of the last 100 years. By it, we rescue annually thousands of humans from temperance, chastity, and sobriety of life. A historical definition of Puritanism is the bottom of page 90 in the syllabus. It's a spiritual movement which developed under Elizabeth I in the late 16th century, or some would argue even earlier. It blossomed in the interregnum of the 1640s and the 1650s, and it withered in the persecution between the Restoration of 1660 and Toleration in 1689. The Puritans, at first, were part of the Church of England, a group within the Church of England whose goal was to push the reform which had begun, and begun well, under Edward VI toward greater perfection in particularly worship and church discipline, and a movement which was concerned to establish righteousness in the culture, and a movement which attempted to convert everyone to a vigorous evangelical faith. I'd like to use the analogy of a plant, a tree, as we think of Puritanism growing from small beginnings to vigorous point in its development and then finally withering and breaking apart. All that takes place in the 17th century, so we're going to scan the history of the 17th century in England to see the rise and the triumph and the collapse of Puritanism. First of all, roots and early growth. Puritan pioneers include such people we've already talked about, as William Tyndale and John Bradford and John Knox and John Hooper. William Tyndale, the Bible translator, John Bradford, one of the Marian martyrs, John Knox, the Scottish reformer who ministered in England during the time of Edward VI and fled to the continent when Mary Tudor began her reign. It was in Frankfurt, on the continent, that we see the issue develop and express between the Anglican side of the English Church and the Puritan side of the English Church. There was a man named Cox, Richard Cox, who felt that the refugee church in Frankfurt, the British refugee church in Frankfurt, should be as close as possible to the church in England. They should do, Cox said, as they had done in England. They should have the face of an English church. And John Knox replied, "The Lord grant it to have the face of Christ's church." That's a Puritan answer, a Puritan statement already before the reign even of Queen Elizabeth. And with John Hooper, we have an early English champion of the regulative principle. We'll talk about that in a few minutes, the reform principle or the regulative principle, or it's sometimes called even the Puritan principle, that in worship we only are allowed to do what God commands. Another great moment in the history of early Puritanism was the translation of the Bible into English, which was accomplished in Geneva. It's called the Genevan Version, based on Tyndall's work, but what is particularly important about the Genevan version is the notes. The notes, the marginal notes, which set forth Calvinism and Puritan teaching, influenced very much by the theology of John Calvin. This was the Bible beloved by the Puritans. This was the Bible brought to America on the Mayflower by the Pilgrim fathers and mothers. And this is the Bible that was used as the Bible of the Westminster Divines, even though the King James Version had been translated by this time. It comes from the year 1611. But that version, King James Version, for sometimes was viewed as a kind of modern, new translation of the Bible. And people wanted to stick to the old, familiar Geneva Version, which they did. It was not until the middle of the 17th century that the King James Version gained wide acceptance. These people within the Church of England had great hopes that Queen Elizabeth would become their champion, but it was not too long into that important queen's long reign that the Puritans realized that they were doomed to be disappointed with Elizabeth. In their opinion, she did not continue and complete the good beginnings that had already been made under her half-brother Edward, but only swept the rubbish behind the door. And the Puritans felt that much more had to be done to bring the English church into line with Christ's church. If they were disappointed with Elizabeth, they became disillusioned with the next ruler, the first of the Stuarts to rule in England, James the First of England, Scottish king, reared among Scottish Presbyterians. And I'm sure many people in England thought as James made his way south from Edinburgh to London in the year 1603, God is really in this, because at last we've got a Presbyterian king who will be sympathetic to our ideals and to our hopes. In fact, many of those Puritans did not wait for James to reach his capital, but marched out to meet him on the way to London and presented him with a petition in which they asked him to commit himself to the kind of church reform that they had long hoped for and worked for. It was called the Millenary Petition because, according to tradition, 1,000 Puritan ministers signed that petition asking James to continue and further the reform of the church. Well, they were soon to be greatly disappointed and disillusioned because the English Puritans learned what the Scottish Presbyterians already knew, and that was that King James was no friend of the Reformed faith. In the Hampton Court Conference, he made it clear that he was the king and he preferred bishops and that he would not tolerate any divergence in the church or in the state. One thing he did, as I mentioned a moment ago, was authorize the translation, a new translation of the Bible, generally called in England the Authorized Version, and in other places the King James Version, in the year 1611. There is a very fulsome dedication to King James in the opening pages of the King James Version of the Bible. But as somebody has said, he will be sorely misled who extends the doctrine of scriptural inerrancy to the dedication preface to the King James Version of the Bible. King James was not nearly as good a king and friend of Protestant Christianity or Puritan Christianity as the dedication in the King James Bible would lead you to believe. Well, disappointment with Elizabeth, disillusionment with James the First, and despair, Charles the First. I suppose the preacher in me is coming out here with those 3 points and all lined up with D's. I was quite pleased when it happened that way. But I didn't work real hard to make it happen that way. I think it's accurate. Despair finally comes to the Puritans as they realize that their high hopes are not going to be realized with the reign of the Stuart kings. With Charles I, there was a high church movement that began to take over in the Church of England. Archbishop William Laud, symbol of Puritan troubles, ruled in the church as Charles ruled in the state. Arminian theology began to infiltrate the Church of England for the first time in a significant way. There was a common saying about this time, "What do the Arminians hold?" And the answer was, "The best bishoprics and deaneries in England." So the Arminians, with Archbishop Laud's approval and support, began to gain places of prestige in the church. And with that despair, you had many of the Puritans leaving. A few had left before the reign of Charles I to go to the Netherlands, and then later to New England, or now to go directly to New England, as thousands of Puritans had given up on Old England, and the immigration to New England, which, as we'll see later, was to be just that, a New England, where God would be honored and the gospel would be preached in its purity, a light set on a hill for the nations. In the 1630s, immigration reached its highest peak, and then in the 1640s, civil war broke out between the king and the parliament. That resulted, as you know, in victory for the parliament and the execution of the king. Charles I was put to death in the year 1649. Let me talk a little bit about that victory in the period of the Commonwealth, 1649 to 1660. For about a decade, England had no king or queen, and this is the period in English history that we call the Commonwealth. It's also the period of Puritan ascendancy. The Puritans now, rather than being a despised minority, became the ruling class in England under a famous man named Oliver Cromwell. I think you'll want to add his name to the syllabus at this point. Oliver Cromwell. He was born in 1599. And died in 1658. He had a very meteoric career. He was a kind of gentleman farmer near Cambridge, elected as an MP, and then rose to be the military and political leader of the Long Parliament. And then after the death of the king, the execution of the king, and the victory of Parliament, he became the Lord Protector of England. At one point, almost became the King of England. A new line of kingship would have been established with Oliver Cromwell, but he did not become king, but Lord Protector. I think Oliver Cromwell is one of the most misunderstood people in English history. Certainly one of the most despised people in English history, even though you can see today before the Houses of Parliament near Westminster Abbey that very impressive statue of Oliver Cromwell. Most people in England would not think of him as a hero, but as a rebel, man who was responsible for the execution of the king and for the period of the Commonwealth, which isn't a period that most English people look to as a great time in English history. But some people see more there in that period of the Commonwealth, and certainly more in Oliver Cromwell. 20 months after he died, September 3rd, 1658, during one of the greatest storms in memory, Charles II sat on his father's throne. So once again, the Stuarts ruled in what's called the Restoration, and the people were singing a song about Oliver Cromwell. Oliver Cromwell is dead and gone. That's the way that song began. But to say something about Oliver Cromwell, to try to set him more in a proper perspective, let me make several points here. First of all, he certainly was an honest man. He did not try to pretend to be something that he was not. You know the famous story about him when a painter was painting his picture, and he looked at it and said, "No, that won't do. You've got to paint the warts and all. Make it more ugly, like I really am. Not so idealized as you have painted it." And that story says something about Oliver Cromwell. I think he was a humble man, even though he became strong leader, almost a dictator in some ways. As you read his prayer, as you sense that here is a man who was humble before the Lord. "Lord," he prayed, "though I am a miserable and wretched creature, I am in covenant with you through grace. And I will come to you for your people." Pray for the people of England. He prayed in that prayer, "Teach those who look too much on your instruments to depend more on yourself. May people not look to me in the Parliament, but to you as their guide and their help." And Cromwell was a great man in many ways. One of the most recent books on Oliver Cromwell by the British historian Christopher Hill, it's called God's Englishman, says, "As long as the great issues of liberty and equality which Oliver raised remain unresolved, so long will he continue to fascinate, and the debate over him will continue." There are many warts as we look at Oliver Cromwell, many shortcomings, many problems, many things that he did wrong. Some of the antagonism between Protestants and Catholics in Northern Ireland today goes back to the time of Oliver Cromwell. So I don't by any means want to make Oliver Cromwell sound better than he really is, but probably no danger in doing that, because Oliver Cromwell is generally made to sound a lot worse than he really is, and I'm trying to balance the scales just a little bit here. So roots and growth. Puritan movement begins and it grows into a great tree, and actually during the time of the Commonwealth, it is the dominant movement religiously and politically in England. Let me talk a little bit now about blossoms and fruit, just to keep the agricultural, the horticultural metaphor going. Some of the products, fruits of the Puritan movement, and I'll limit myself, although it's hard to do this, to just five names. This list could go on and on and on. Actually, we could have a whole course. We could just stop right here and not do anything else but the Puritans for the rest of the semester and summer school and next semester and for several other years after that, because there's a lot to read and a lot to study, but I'll have to do it in 5 minutes. But here are some of the great names. John Milton, great Puritan poet and scholar. You undoubtedly have read some of his works, Paradise Lost, Paradise Regained, Samson Agonistes. One of Milton's biographers has written that John Milton was in all likelihood the last person to read everything that had ever been published. That's an amazing statement, and of course nobody could say anything like that today, but it's hard to imagine even in the 17th century that somebody could read everything that had ever been published. I imagine we have to limit that to English and Latin and a few of the European languages, but publishing, at least printing, was not all that old. It could be that John Milton did read about everything that had been written or published. Read Milton. Read him for the greatness of his language. Get caught up in these great poems and the greatness and grandeur of the ideas and language of John Milton. But be a little cautious. Be more than a little cautious with his theology. Even though this man is a Puritan, he's tainted a bit with Arianism and Arminianism, at least seems to be at certain points in his writings. So you don't really go to John Milton for theology. Go to him for the splendor of his imagination and the greatness of his poems. And then Richard Baxter, the great preacher, pastor. He spent 15 years in the little town of Kidderminster near Birmingham in England, and left his mark on that place that lasted 100 years. He's a great preacher. Baxter's preaching aphorism was this: first light, then heat. Not a bad thing to remember in preaching. First light, then heat. And he was a great pastor. One of the important books in pastoral theology is Baxter's The Reformed Pastor. That is not really a word that means the Calvinist pastor, although many and most of the pastors that would read this book would have been Calvinists, but Reformed in the sense of revived or renewed. Reformed pastor. I was talking with one of the students just before coming over here to teach, and I had not said anything about the Reformed pastor and Richard Baxter, but he was telling me he had read this book, and he said, "I almost decided I couldn't be a pastor. This was it. This was the end," because Richard Baxter has such a high standard and makes it seem impossible that I don't think I could ever do this. Well, read The Reformed Pastor, but don't have that reaction, because that book is a goal that we can set before us, and few, if anybody, is ever going to reach that goal in its perfection. In fact, Richard Baxter himself did not. Read Richard Baxter. Read him for evangelism. A call to the unconverted. Read him for his spiritual counsel, the wonderful Saints' Everlasting Rest. Read him for church renewal, the Reformed Pastor, I was just talking about, which he so incisively touches the life and heart of ministers. Some people had complained that he wrote that book in English, as he wrote his other books in English. And Baxter's response was, "If the ministers of England had sinned only in Latin, I would have admonished them in Latin. But if they will sin in English, they must hear of it in English." And he certainly lets them hear of it in English. But watch out a little bit for Baxter's theology, for his neo-nomianism. And then John Owen. You don't have to watch out for John Owen's theology. Read John Owen for his theology. Here is the John Calvin of England. In his Death of Death and the Death of Christ, one of the great theological books of England, and we have the theology of John Owen in concentrated form, which is something of a miracle, in the Savoy Declaration, as Owen's on Puritan Westminster confession convictions are expressed in that document, which represents English congregationalism. Spurgeon said it is unnecessary to say that Owen is the prince of divines. To master his works is to be a profound theologian. But large task, because Owen writes a lot and isn't always easy to read. But if you can master his style, a very concise style, you'll learn to appreciate how much Owen can pack into a very few pages. And then John Bunyan, one of my favorites. The Tinker of Bedford, who wrote wonderful spiritual autobiography called Grace Abounding to the Chief of Sinners. And then certainly one of the greatest books ever written, Pilgrim's Progress, the Westminster Confession of Faith with people in it. Somebody has called Pilgrim's Progress. I have 36 editions of Pilgrim's Progress in my library, and I try to read it once every year or two. I'm reading it now. I have all those editions because I like the different illustrations and some different languages and different ways in which Pilgrim's Progress has been published through the years. And then there's time to just mention one other great Puritan, John Flavel, called the Seaman's Preacher. He was pastor at Dartmouth in England, ejected at the time of the Restoration, but he continued to serve his seafaring congregation, even though he was locked out of his church, preaching from a rock in the harbor. Plain, earnest, Puritan writer. So typical of the Puritans. Flavel said, "A crucified style best suits the preachers of a crucified Christ." And I add John Flavel to this short list, which could be much longer, because of the influence that Flavel had on the old Princeton Seminary and through that on both Northern and Southern Presbyterianism. Now let's come to the withering and the breaking of the great Puritan tree. What went wrong? Commonwealth was the realization of a long dream that English Puritans and their allies, the Scottish Presbyterians, would be in control of the church and the state. I think two things went wrong, and we can learn from these, so let me take a few moments to set these before you. First, divisions in Puritan ranks. The Puritans were better in opposition than they were in authority. They were good pointing out what was wrong with other people, but when they gained authority, they had a hard time getting along with each other. Presbyterians versus Independents. Cromwell's army fought not only the Catholics in Ireland, but also the Presbyterians in Scotland. And then many other groups developed. Radical groups in the Puritan movement, the Baptists, the Levellers, the Diggers, the Ranters, the Fifth Monarchists, the Quakers. Puritanism began to splinter. And the Puritans had adopted a kind of all-or-nothing approach. So they found it very difficult to compromise with people that they probably should have compromised with in order to have a more united front and to represent more of the people of England. Dr. Martin Lloyd-Jones wrote, "If the Puritans had but stood together for religious toleration in general rather than any one system, the history at that time and during the next 300 years would have been very different." The second thing that went wrong is that there was too much of a mixture of religion and politics. Now, I certainly admire the Puritans for their concern to represent Christ over all culture, to be involved in science and education and in statecraft. That is an ideal that we all hold before us with a reformed world and life view. But John Owen himself said that the influence of civil or political intrigues and considerations undermine the Puritan movement. It was not that they made a mistake in wanting to have influence in culture, but they made a mistake in the way they attempted to go about it. Dr. Lloyd-Jones wrote, "May we learn the lesson of 1640 to 1662 and keep clear of any such worldly entanglements. Let us fight the battle of the Lord with spiritual weapons." Puritans were fighting the battle of the Lord with spiritual weapons, but also with very real swords in their battles with the Catholics of Ireland, for instance, in which many of those people were killed by the Puritans. The Restoration came in 1660 with Charles II, the son of the executed king, back on the throne, or on the throne now, of England. The Act of Uniformity in 1662 meant that all English ministers had to conform to the Anglican ideal. Those who could not or would not were ejected in the Great Ejection of 1662, when some 2,000 ministers, like Flavel, left their churches and preached then out of doors or wherever they could. This was the beginning of official nonconformity in religious history in England, followed by 2 decades of suffering, imprisonment, as in the case of John Bunyan, who was put in prison and wrote his great book, at least partially during his years in prison, until finally the glorious revolution of William and Mary and toleration of 1689, which we will come to later. Let me end by giving a few words to summarize the Puritan mind and soul, as we did for the Anglicans in the previous lecture. One word we would use here is thoroughness. I use the word comprehensiveness for the Anglicans, but thoroughness for the Puritans. The Puritans were thorough, exhaustive in anything they did or anything they wrote about. You'll realize that if you try to read Richard Baxter's million-word book, Christian Directory, it's called, or A Sum of Practical Theology, Cases of Conscience, Directing Christians How to Use Their Knowledge and Faith, How to Improve All Helps and Means, and to Perform All Duties, How to Overcome Temptations, and to Escape or Mortify Every Sin, all in one book. It's a big book, and the Puritans leave no stone unturned in their attempt to deal with every single thing. Baxter could see this spirit in others, particularly in his wife. He would remind her from time to time, "Overdoing is undoing. If you do too much, you won't do anything." But he never could see it in himself. Wonder if Richard Baxter should have gone fishing more. That could be an interesting exam question, although it's not in my list. Should the Puritans have spent more time fishing, like Isaac Walton? Walton actually praised one of the Puritans in his Complete Angler. He praised our learned William Perkins, one of the great Puritan theologians. He praised Perkins because of his commendations of angling. That man also fished, and so the Puritan and the Anglican saw eye to eye on at least one thing. Biblical worship. With the Anglicans, I stress beauty in worship. With the Puritans, biblical worship. The regulative principle, or the reform principle, now becomes the Puritan principle. And in the name of that principle, the Puritans refused vestments and removed crosses and pictures and organs and candles and feast days, including Easter and Christmas, and the list goes on and on. The regulative principle is a very important principle, but not always easy to apply. In their preaching, the Puritans were champions of grace, grace abounding to the chief of sinners. It's the name of Bunyan's book, and that could stand for the whole period. And they were very concerned to teach the law, to set forth the Ten Commandments and God's requirements for Christian living. Sometimes it's thought that the Puritans fell into legalism, and they probably did. We know Baxter did in his Neo-Nomianism. And even in John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, Charles Spurgeon is disappointed when in the beginning of the story, evangelist sends poor Christian, not really yet a Christian, although that's his name already, sends him to the wicket gate and not directly to the cross. Well, Bunyan doesn't often get it wrong, but there he perhaps did. The way from the preaching of the gospel was an indirect way, not a direct way, to the cross. And the Puritans do stress that law work. They preach the law. It's important, I think, and they do it well and they do it right, but you can preach the law so long, you should not wait too long to get to the gospel. And I think the Puritans kept people often marinating in the law too long. They needed to let them go on to the gospel and be forgiven when the conviction was there. But by and large, the Puritans were, as J.I. Packer put it, law-oriented without lapsing into legalism. I would agree with that by saying the Puritans were usually law-oriented and did not usually lapse into legalism, but I think there are places where we can see that. But there is much good in what the Puritans do with the law. Great stress on the third use of the law and careful teaching of what God requires, but it can produce books that seem beyond us. And as you read the Puritans, don't allow Puritan writing to discourage you, as sometimes it can. There are many great encouraging things in the Puritans too, but the standards are so high that we can feel like we can never make it. Of course, the standards in the Bible are so high that we can feel like we can never make it. But I remember reading once that John Duncan, the 19th century Scottish theologian, was reading the Puritan Thomas Shepherd. And he said, Shepherd is fine, but the problem with Shepherd is I wish I was as good as one of his hypocrites. And you can kind of get that feeling occasionally in reading the Puritans. We have a right to criticize some of the Puritans, perhaps many of the Puritans, for pruning the tree too closely, but it's wrong to suppose that there should be no pruning. Whether we look at worship or at Christian conduct, something corresponding to the Puritan criticism is always needed. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Quite make it. 2 minutes. Yes. Neo-Nomianism is the expression that's used for Baxter's teaching in which he was attempting to answer the opposite position to him, which seemed to be something like an easy believism. Not really too much grace, but grace taught in a certain way that would lead to an antinomianism. So both in English history and Scottish history for a long time, maybe all the way down to the present, really, in American history, there's that tension between antinomianism, not thinking significantly enough of the law, and neo-nomianism, bringing the law back in some way, in a way that perhaps clouds what justification by grace and faith really is all about? I think that's a danger that we need to constantly be on guard against, particularly on the reform side of things, that we can, with our stress on the third use of the law, bring law sort of back in. It doesn't save us, but maybe it keeps us saved, or you know, it does something else like that. On the Lutheran side, there's the opposite problem. So we're good for each other. You know, a Lutheran should talk to a Presbyterian occasionally, and we should talk to Lutherans occasionally. Well, we'll have to stop.